Good afternoon, everybody. Shmuel Plotzer coming at you live. It's Book Club, weekly book club class through Gulf Atlantic Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies. Welcome aboard. It is Monday, and it is August 21 of the year 23, and we are reading the book called The Return to Zion, Addresses on Religious Zionism and American Orthodoxy by the one and only Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik of Yeshiva University. So I couldn't make it last week. We were in South Central Pennsylvania, and we were on a tour of a farm, and we just couldn't get out of that, and it was a really nice one, too. But we're in the middle of a chapter of an address called, And a Man Wrestled with Him. It's going to be all about the Jewish, you know, life and times and the world and Jewish history and how do we understand it and how does the world understand us. Everybody, come on in. Hopefully you'll enjoy it. We're going to do a little bit of review. We're going to start from page 87 today. Here we go. And by the way, this lecture was given, of course, all these lectures were given in Yiddish. This one, May 1946, and a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn. Before we paint a visionary picture of the future of the Jewish people, we must have a clear picture of the present. However, by picture of the present, I don't simply mean newspaper reports, but rather a deeper understanding. We must derive from current events a pair of historical principles or laws that are operative in our fateful existence and formulate them clearly. I don't seek here to provide any cures for antisemitism, because I don't know what can heal that illness. I seek only to trace in clear terms the historical profile of our fate. Whether it is good or bad is entirely immaterial, since history does not ask us how it should play itself out. Principle A. The Jewish question and antisemitism are not bound up exclusively with political structures like fascism and democracy on the one hand, or economic systems like capitalism and socialism on the other. Certainly, it was a fascist power that became the Jewish people's Amalek. But in essence, German bestial antisemitism was nourished less by fascist political theories than by the specific psychology and particular structure of the German mentality. Italy, despite its fascist regime, was not anti-Semitic, so long as it was not allied with Hitler. The danger is obviously far greater when the government is fascist, because then every demagogue and murderer can exploit the anti-Semitic predilections of his nation for his own purposes and massacre millions of people. However, I can well imagine a democratic Germany with a Treblinka and Majdanek in the background. The entire nation knew what was going on. Russia is no democracy, and yet it is also not anti-Semitic. By contrast, the liberated countries of Europe, like Czechoslovakia, Poland, France, and Holland, are, despite their democratic institutions, poisoned with anti-Semitism. You could argue that wherever there is anti-Semitism, there is ipso facto no democracy. Granted. But I believe that what gets called democracy in the language of political philosophy is still no guarantee of philo-Semitism. Likewise, neither capitalism nor socialism secures the fate of the Jews. At its core, Nazism was not a capitalistic movement. The labor government in England does not treat us any better than do the capitalist conservatives. And in certain ways, it treats us even worse. I wish to stress that my words should not be interpreted as asserting that we Jews are uninterested in political governmental structures and social justice issues like labor rights. Heaven forbid. Our entire Torah is founded upon the demand for justice for the weak and oppressed and equality for all. We fight alongside everyone else for social ideals. However, again, the Jewish question will not be solved through social or political changes. Yalkut Shimoni, quote, Rabbi Shmuel said, the five fingers of the Almighty God all hint at redemption. The Blessed Holy One used the pinky finger to demonstrate how to build the Teva, the Ark. As it says, this is how you shall make it, Genesis 6. He used the ring finger to smite the Egyptians, as it says, Etzpa Lakimhu, this is the finger of God, Exodus 8, end quote. The finger used to redeem the world by bringing a deluge and eradicating evil, plunder, and brutality is not the same finger as the one used to redeem Israel by fighting Pharaoh. Pharaoh was persecuting Jews after the deluge, after the wicked had been annihilated and drowned in the flood of their own crimes. And the master of the universe has a special finger on his hand for dealing with the Jewish question. Jews must know and remember this, because they very often forget it. The socialist youth at the time of the Russian Revolution forgot it. The Western European assimilationists failed to understand it. And even many of our ilk do not grasp it, as when they buttress their support for the return to Zion on humanitarian grounds. I wish to emphasize again that I am not one of the Sholalei Hagalut, the diaspora negators, or the alarmists who yell that Jews living in the diaspora are finished and their situation is hopeless. Such declarations are silly, even when they emanate from the land of Israel. However, I want Jews to remember that their problems will not be solved by the Atlantic Charter, even if the whole document were to be put into practice, all the more so given that the entire dream has come to nothing. The struggle for the fair treatment of Jews is still far from won, even in the freest democracies, and despite the best intentions of their governments. If the Jewish question is not simply a problem of the weak and helpless, but has a specifically Jewish overtone, then we must come to an appreciation of what is different and distinctive about our history and find a way to formulate it. I believe that the entire complex exists more on the metaphysical plane than on the economic political plane. And now we start fresh material on page 89 at the top. Principle B. The byword of Jewish history is, quote, a man wrestled with Jacob until the break of dawn, Genesis 32. There is a tension between the historical fate of the Jews and world history, a conflict between Israel and the man, whoever he may be, Samael or Michael, the devil, or cultural antisemitism. This tension between our history and general history, the opposition between Jacob and his environment, his present surroundings, is the driving force behind our historical fate. It could be that such a history is tragic and foolish. I do not wish to argue about this with anyone, but it is a historical fact. What is the source of the tension between the distinctly Jewish and general destinies? I wish here to become a simple believer of the old sort and give a conventional answer. The source is, quote, you have chosen us. Bacharta osanu. Osanu bacharta, however you'll phrase that in the Hebrew. You have chosen us. Bacharta banu. You have chosen us. Despite the fact that the Reconstructionists seek to remove the election of Israel from their new sitter. In what way is our election manifest? In our being different? In our paradoxical historical existence? We constitute a... I'm sorry, that's actually his answer. In what way is our election manifest? In our being different. In our paradoxical historical existence. We constitute a paradox for the world, an irrational phenomenon, an unfathomable peculiarity to which the simple laws of sociological existence cannot be applied. First, our very survival for 2,000 years under the most horrible conditions, as well as our stubbornly clinging to our faith, presents a paradox. Second, the Gentiles do not know how to classify us from a political, philosophical standpoint as a religion, a nation, a race. The phenomenon of prophecy and its practitioners, their claims against the public and their demands, were also paradoxical. Jewish faith, with its halakhic structure, with An ox that gores a cow. See Bava Kama 5. An egg born on a festival. See Bea chapter 1. It's paradoxical. The God of Israel, the unseen God who rules the world and insists that man lead an ethical life, is incomprehensible to the Gentiles. Both to the Greeks, who sought to observe reality in concrete terms and through the prism of many gods, and to the Christians, who invented a God-man for themselves. Our temple, with its mysterious Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, where there was still an old stone during the Second Temple, about which the ancient world told legends, was paradoxical for the Gentiles. Moreover, our contemporary mode of worshiping God, without ceremonies and cultic practices, is paradoxical. Shabbos has been paradoxical since Greek times. The Talmud, paradoxical. Our calendar, also paradoxical. In a word, at the point when Abraham lifted his axe, smashed Terach's gods, and became Abraham HaIvri, the Hebrew, who is called that because, quote, the entire world is on one ever, one side, and he is on the other. He is Me'ever HaNahar. He's on the other side of the river. See Bereishis Rabbah, section 42. Ever since then, the paradox of the Jew, the inscrutable, forever mysterious, enigmatic Jew, as well as the opposition to him, a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn, came into existence. This tension is not the same as xenophobia, hatred of the stranger. We are nowhere strangers. Rather, it is the tension with that which one does not grasp or understand. In this sense, goodwill meetings will be of no use, because as much as we might explain and as many books as we might write about all that Jewry has given the world, there remains for the Gentiles a single problem: your existence as a distinct group, nation, race, religious community, is itself the greatest mystery, one that we will not tolerate and that must disappear. Hitler sought to massacre us. Good-hearted Gentiles wish to convert us or completely assimilate us. Not our beard, captains, language, or even our practical observance, but rather our very existence is paradoxical. As paradoxical as the para aduma, the red heifer, just as the red heifer is the symbol of paradox and inscrutability in the Torah, so do the Jews represent the paradox of world history. The Christian refers to this as the curse of the eternal Jew, while we call it the election of eternal Israel. When Haman said, "Their laws are different from those of any other people," he correctly diagnosed the problem. However, our existence is paradoxical not only to the outside world, but to ourselves as well. Perhaps we don't understand ourselves and consider ourselves enigmatic. But the main irrationality lies in our martyrdom, our suffering. Our sense of paradox is not the same as the Gentiles. The nations of the world do not comprehend our existence, while we do not comprehend our tormented existence, our distinct existence, as representatives of the God of Israel, whom the world has yet to recognize, as bearers of a great prophecy of justice, of brightness, and mercy, and as dreamers about the end of days. Why do we experience so much suffering? I know that this is a problem that troubles the mind of any thinking person. And do not expect me to answer the perennial question of suffering. There is no answer to that question. What I wish to do this evening is simply to formulate the question in the proper light so that we can grasp the second paradox of our history, the mystery of our suffering. This paradox is wonderfully illustrated in the Rosh Hashanah Torah reading, in the portion of the Akedas Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac. After we finish recounting the entire heroic story of the binding, how Abraham was ready to sacrifice his only son, but at the last moment the angel stopped him and showed him eternal love. Genesis 22, I will bestow my blessing upon you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars of heaven and the sands of the sea. All the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by your descendants. Then comes a short passage. Quote, sometime later, Abraham was told, Milcah too has borne children to your brother Nahor, who is the firstborn, and Booz his brother, and Kemuel, the father of Aram, and Chesed, Hazo, Pildash, Yidlaf, and Betuel, Betuel being the father of Rebekah. These eight Milcah bore to Nahor, Abraham's brother, and his concubine, whose name was Reuma, also bore children, Teva, Gaham, Tahash, and Maacha. See Genesis 22. End quote. Everyone asks, why does the Torah need to tell us this? And why must I know how many children Nahor had? Rashi, the Ramban, and the Ibn Ezra answer that the whole purpose of the passage is to introduce Rivka. However, this is difficult to accept. Moreover, it does not explain why we have to read this portion on Rosh Hashanah. What connection does it have with the sanctity of the day, with the day of judgment? We should have closed with the pasuk, Abraham then returned to his servants, and they departed together for Beersheba, and Abraham stayed in Beersheba. Genesis 22. The fact that Chazal included the last five verses of the Akedah, the binding, in the Rosh Hashanah reading tells us that our picture of the Akedah, of the binding, is incomplete without those verses. The entire drama only begins to resolve with the anecdote about Nahor. Yes, Morai v'Rabotai, the greatness of the binding of Isaac lies not in the fact of Abraham bringing his son as an offering, in his readiness for self-sacrifice. Jews are not unique in having sacrificed for the sake of a great ideal. General history has recorded instances of superhuman heroism, readiness for self-sacrifice, giving one's life, courageously falling in battle. Greek and Roman history and literature are full of heroes. Homer's Iliad and Odyssey are hero epics. Abraham is not the only one to give of himself. Other figures also demonstrated superhuman heroism. The superhumanity of Abraham's act consists not in the sacrifice itself, but in the paradoxical, irrational character of that sacrifice. While Homer's heroes were logical and rationally consistent in their behavior, and their sacrifices were needed in practice in order to defend the homeland and the nation's honor. In other words, healthy logic demanded such sacrifices. Abraham's sacrifice was the wildest, most illogical, unfathomable, and paradoxical. Think about it. A man discovers the master of the universe, the one God, the invisible God, whom the rest of the world does not acknowledge. This new natural metaphysics and recognition of God is not simply a theoretical achievement, but the start of a new life ideology, a new ethics of loving kindness, justice, and righteousness, a new era of values, human rights, fairness, and uprightness has begun. Abraham does not keep it a mystery, his private possession, but rather spreads this new Torah to all. He planted a tamarisk at Beersheba and invoked there the name of God, the everlasting God, Genesis 21. Abraham forges a future for an eternal Israel, a new world of prophecy, and the end of days. He hopes that this world does not follow him to the grave, but rather conquers all and becomes the kingdom of the Almighty. His descendants will fight for it, future generations will build and safeguard it. For I have singled him out that he may instruct his children and his posterity to keep the way of God by doing what is just and right. Genesis 18. Wow. And here is where the first paradoxical, enigmatic thing in Abraham's life comes into the picture. Abraham and Sarah, of all people, are infertile. The master of the universe makes him promises regarding the land of Israel, his descendants, and the Jewish nation. But these are incredible. It feels at times that God is teasing or laughing at him. Heaven forbid. I will make of you a great nation, and all the families of the earth shall bless themselves by you. See Genesis 12. Yet Abraham has only a nephew to whom this great spiritual inheritance cannot be left. For I give all the land that you see to you and your offspring forever. I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth. Genesis 13. Yet Abraham and Sarah have grown old and have no children. God appears to him once more and again gives him assurances and visions of a glorious future. So shall your offspring be. Genesis 15. Yet Abraham is childless. Everyone is presumably laughing, scoffing at him. This is the reward for your struggle? This is the divine world you're building? With your death, everything will be scattered by the wind. Abraham later has a son, not with Sarah, but with Hagar. Again, ironic and ridiculous. Sarah cannot bear children. And once the boy has grown a bit, Abraham understands that he cannot leave his great inheritance to such a wild man. See Genesis 16. A peta Adam. And then there are further promises. Avram becomes Abraham, Avraham, the father of a multitude of nations. Genesis 17. Yet his fate is brutish and cruel. At this point, people have probably already stopped scoffing at Abraham. Instead, they look at him with pity, as at a maniac who believes in a mysterious, paradoxical God, who himself laughs at him. Sarah no longer believes. And Sarah laughed to herself, saying, now that I am withered, am I to have enjoyment? Genesis 18. But Abraham continues to have faith. Faith at any cost. Because he put his trust in God, God reckoned it to his merit. Genesis 15. Finally, the happy moment arrives. The Almighty took note of Sarah. Genesis 21. And Isaac is born. Abraham has achieved his goal. Abraham has prevailed. Abraham's faith has proved correct. His God was not laughing at him, was not deceiving him. Heaven forbid. All of his neighbors see God's hands. Everyone who hears will laugh with me. Genesis 21. But then suddenly a new paradox, a new prank, a new enigma emerges. Take your son, your favored one, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering. Genesis 22. Obliterate everything. Undo all the assurances. Uproot everything that you have planted. Trample it all. Bring Isaac as a sacrifice. And what will become of the great vision for a Jewish nation? Nothing. Is there then any wilder, crazier, more irrational sacrifice than this one? By bringing this offering, Abraham could accomplish none of his goals, could implement none of his ideals. On the contrary, he would be destroying everything. It would constitute the annihilation of all he had built and planted during his long life. Herein lies the greatness of this sacrifice, one that contradicts the most basic logic. However, the paradox is not complete without the anecdote about Nahor. Immediately after the binding, Abraham was told, Milcah too has born children to your brother Nahor. Abraham, you have a brother named Nahor who did not recognize the creator of the world, did not give the world a new Torah, and did not discover a system of ethics. Rather, he lived a comfortable, plain, egotistical life, contented with himself and his sheep. He too had sons, but without all the hardships, torments, waiting, and growing old, without the whole zigzag of paradoxes, enigmas, and disappointments. 8 sons, one after the other, came from Milcah, Uz, Booz, Kemuel, Chesed, Hazo, Pildash, Yidlaf, Besuel. The world has no need of them. They will not implement any ideals, will not take on any missions. A simple man of flesh and blood, an idolater who built no eternity, was given 12 sons, including the 4 born to Reuma, the concubine, without pain and suffering, while you, Abraham, with all your aspirations and hopes, revolutionary life's journey and chosenness, you were forced to go down the martyr's path without any assurance that you would not have to go through a new binding the next day. Morai v'rabotai, this is the portrait of the Akedah, of the binding of Isaac. It is not the sacrifice that is at the center of the drama, but rather that which is paradoxical, irrational, and incomprehensible. The torments of an illogical life that is full of contradictions, and is not the biography of the forefathers, the story of hardships, consisting of contradictions, of claims against God, for whom they fought and whose Torah they sought to transform into a universal world order. Our rabbis formulated this idea in connection with the pasuk, quote, I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as Kael Shakai, but I did not make myself known to them by my name Havaya. See Exodus 6, verse 3. See Rashi there. Abraham was given the land of Israel, yet he had to pay the Hittites 400 shekel of silver, Genesis 23, for a grave for Sarah. Isaac, too, was childless at first, and when he ultimately was blessed with children, one of them was Esav, who represented the forces fighting against Abraham's and Isaac's moral world. Moreover, Esav was the firstborn. Then there was the tension between the brothers, Jacob's escape, the stories of Laban, Shechem, and Joseph, and the immigration from the land of destiny to Egypt, a foreign country associated with a dark future. Quote, know well that your offspring will be strangers in a land not theirs. Genesis 15. Struggles, oppositions, torments, paradoxes, zigzags, irrationalities, caprices of hate, and incomprehensibilities. It is commonly assumed that Job is a book of suffering that seeks to solve the problem of evil in the world. But no one realizes that Genesis 2 is a book of suffering. From the birth of Abraham to the death of Jacob, the difference between the books is threefold. Number one, Job is a pan-human document. Job's tragedy is a general story of suffering by an individual persecuted by fate. We do not even know if Job was a Jew. His friends represented various nationalities. The book is, in truth, a dialogue between members of an international group discussing the problem of suffering. Genesis, by contrast, is a typical book of Jewish suffering, a national document representing the specificity of the Jewish people. Number two, Job is a book of pain, while Genesis is a book of suffering. Three, Job treats the metaphysics of suffering and speaks to God, while Genesis treats the ethics of suffering and speaks to man. Let us focus on the second point and consider it more closely. Pain and suffering are two distinct concepts. Pain is a physiological, psychological phenomenon. The term is usually applied to physical hurts resulting from organic disruptions. It refers to a plain sensation like sight or hearing, or taste, and it is experienced by man and beast alike. When an animal is sick or wounded, it too has colossal aches and sensations of pain. It is a natural reaction of the brain and nervous system to a physiological disharmony. Sometimes among human beings, it can advance in the opposite direction, beginning with the psyche and then spreading to bodily functions. For example, great upset caused by shame, insult, anger, or shock also gives rise to feelings of pain in which body and psyche jointly participate. It is quite likely that animals too have similar experiences, but none of this constitutes suffering. Suffering is not just about pain, but about the human spirit and consciousness reacting to and assessing it, applying to it a value judgment, considering it from the standpoint of a particular ideal or principle, and then labeling it as bad, evil, or hostile. Suffering results from a person measuring pain using an ethical yardstick and finding it unethical and diabolical. Take, for example, the case of a happy mother who goes into labor. She certainly has pains, colossal aches, but no one would be so crazy as to argue that she experiences suffering, which has a negative connotation. On the contrary, she is jubilant and content. Her life takes on new meaning, and she herself feels young and bold. Quote, the barren woman bears 7. See 1 Samuel chapter 2. Her evaluation and assessment of these pains are positive. The pains do not collide with her ethical norms, and she views them as good, as a blessing, and not as a curse. Pain is a physiological, psychological phenomenon. Suffering entails a spiritual, ethical, value-assigning act. Even when a pain is identified with suffering, there is still a big difference between the two. The feeling of hurt cannot persist indefinitely. In the moment, the sensation is very strong and pervasive, shattering all of a person's defenses. The whole world collapses for someone afflicted by pain. But the intensity abates, and gradually the aching grows fainter and fainter. Convulsive pain does not last forever. Spiritual suffering, by contrast, is not so convulsive and spasmodic. It does not overcome a person. It is calm and still. What it lacks in intensity and sharpness, however, it makes up for in stubborn continuity and persistence. It does not leave man for even one moment. Like a shadow, it accompanies him everywhere until he reaches his grave. If a mother loses her only child, God help us. The initial pain is terrible, convulsive, hysterical. She tears out her hair, screams, wants to commit suicide. But this must subside with time. The physiological, psychological reaction must lose its intensity and acuteness. However, her spiritual suffering, her feeling of loneliness, her ethical embitterment against nature and providence, and her inner protest against the world order and fate never dissipate. They remain forever and never diminish. Job had colossal, convulsive pains. A bacchanalia of afflictions befell him, and he sought to solve the problem of physiological, psychological pain, but failed to do so. He did not succeed in learning from God the secret of pain, just as the Greeks were unable to solve the mystery of fate. Genesis, however, is not a book of pain, but of suffering. The forefathers had few plain physical pains, holding aside Jacob's tragedies with Rachel and Joseph, the common thread running throughout Genesis is the silent suffering of lonely people who bore in their hearts a great vision of a bright future, but were misunderstood and derided. This is the suffering of being different, of a paradoxical existence that, despite everything and in defiance of everyone, sanctified a sublime idea and that dreams and hopes to build a great, beautiful world. Let me read that again. This is the suffering of being different, of a paradoxical existence that, despite everything and in defiance of everyone, sanctified a sublime idea and the dreams and hopes to build a great, beautiful world. This is the suffering of the future, endured in the midst of a present filled with brutality and insensitivity. This is the suffering of redemption. And here is the main difference between Job and the book of Genesis. Job wished to formulate a metaphysics of suffering. He carried on a dialogue with God, who caused his pains. Job sought to understand providence. Genesis, though, constitutes an ethics of suffering, a dialogue with man about how he should approach and relate to suffering. Metaphysical problems never troubled us Jews. We never asked, as did the Greeks, quote, what came before and what comes after? See Chagiga chapter 2. We have always been interested in ethical questions. If we ever sought to understand the world, it was for ethical reasons, to know how we should live and behave in such a world. Maimonides forbade attaching to the Almighty such attributes as have no ethical significance for us. See Hilchos Deos chapter 1. See Moreh Nevuchim chapter 1. We have also viewed God as the source of ethics. We seek to understand suffering ethically as well. How should we relate to suffering in the present? Job's pains yielded nothing. Maybe at the end he had a few more donkeys and camels and perhaps more beautiful daughters. By contrast, through the suffering of the forefathers in Genesis, a Jewish nation was born. Jewish history was forged and fashioned via the paradoxical and enigmatic suffering of a derided, lonely dreamer and prophet. Jacob's tussle with the man, and a man wrestled with him, gave rise to Israel, for you have striven with beings divine and human. See Genesis 32, in opposition to the historical angels and human history. A perpetual tension, an ongoing paradox, an everlasting enigma, and yet you have prevailed, said the angel to Jacob. Job is struck by fate, a malicious Satan, Chaldeans, Sabians, and a whirlwind, and he could not find a solution to his problems. By contrast, Abraham transformed his fate into destiny, self-determination, and free choice, and he achieved immortality. The Jewish answer to suffering is, if fate is nasty and brutish, challenge it. Conquer it. For you have striven with beings divine and human, and you have prevailed. And out of blind fate and irrational, paradoxical existence, you will fashion a teleologically meaningful reality. In returning to the present and attempting to understand it, which is almost impossible, we must sharply distinguish between pain and suffering. Over the past 10 years, we have experienced cataclysmic afflictions and convulsive pains in the purely physiological, psychological sense. Perhaps even wild animals could not endure them. Biologically speaking, we have gone through mortal torments and physical torture previously completely unknown in human history. We have no explanation for these pains, and no philosopher or metaphysician can solve this mystery, just like Job did not discover the secret of his pains. However, The period of our sharp physical hurt is behind us, thank God. The bacchanalia of afflictions has disappeared in conjunction with the downfall of the evil regime. May its name be blotted out. Majdanek is destroyed. Treblinka is no more. A few murderers have been hanged. Thank God for that. Only now begins the silent suffering, the suffering of a young widow who, following Shiva and the subsiding of her mourning convulsions, remains alone and lonely and grieves modestly, quietly, for the husband of her youth. This suffering has two elements. Number one, the memory of the destruction, the image of the desolate cities and towns where Jewish life had blossomed, of mute, naked walls, of flowers growing in the fields of Treblinka, fertilized with the ashes of our brethren. Number two, the relationship of the outside world to us over the course of the years of slaughter, as well as of today when it comes to saving the survivors, and generally the lack of sympathy and understanding for our tragedy among the nations of the world is deplorable. Their cold, indifferent, cynical attitude causes us unbearable suffering. The amazing thing about all of this is that this society is actually cultured and supposedly speaks of mercy and uprightness. When we consider the present situation from a historical ethical standpoint, we must assert that to analyze the cataclysmic pains of these last 4 years and ask why is futile and leads only to despair. We dare not imitate Job with his questions. They lead nowhere. But we also dare not, and it would constitute a historical crime if we were to do so. We dare not ignore our quiet, continual, daily suffering, which derives from the loneliness of the modern Jew, from the indifference of the nations of the world, from the lack of assurance that they will not say to us one fine day, quote, go away from us, for you have become far too big for us. See Genesis 26. From the awareness that there is a chasm, mysterious and unfathomable, that separates the Jew from the Gentile. From the fate that we very often become the scapegoat for every tyrant and demagogue. Our paradoxical character brings us suffering. We dare not allow all of this to simply remain a paradoxical fate, an illogical an incomprehensible enigma. Rather, it must be transformed into destiny, self-determination, and free choice. Our current book is not Job, but Genesis. Abraham's motto was, a nation is born of paradoxes and suffering. Our motto must be, a nation is reborn of paradoxes and suffering. I'll read that again. Abraham's motto was, a nation is born of paradoxes and suffering. Our motto must be, a nation is reborn of paradoxes and suffering. Quote, and a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn. Following the generations-long tussle between the Knesset Yisrael and historical fate, the sun, the morning star of a new era, must rise. How so? Through assimilatory measures, or as recommended by other extreme Orthodox parties, through complete isolation from Western culture, compressing our existence into sectarianism, sealed off and secluded from the temple of modern times? You know quite well that both solutions are empty dreams. Jews cannot assimilate, and Gentiles will not start liking them for doing so. At the same time, we cannot enclose ourselves within a great wall of China and break off all of our connections with the surrounding culture. The segment of Orthodoxy preaching such a strategy is insincere. They do not raise their own children this way. And I hate hypocrisy, believing one thing and saying another. But if our history is one of tension between Avraham HaIvri Abraham, the Hebrew, and his environment. It is also one of contact with the world and its culture. Tension is a type of relationship, a kind of connection with the opposing side. Where there is isolation, there can be no tension. If positive electricity is not united with negative electricity, there is no electrical tension, and no dynamic electricity or electrical current can be produced. Only contact and unification yield the tension that results in electrical sparks and a current. Our history, from our forefather Abraham onward, is one of constant contact with world history, connection with general culture, and collaboration as well. By the same token, however, there remains the paradoxical tension of those lonely wanderers who saw a great vision and sought to establish their splendid prophecy as the fundament of a new world. Such suffering opens new horizons and a new morning. And a new morning star beckons to us from the historical distance. At the same time, there approaches another moment, the moment of vengeance. We Jews wish to take revenge against the German murderers of a third of our people. We have always maintained that vengeance is sometimes necessary and holy, because evil must at times be eradicated with violence. The Hebrew Bible, with its passionate avenging God, spilled far less blood. Nachum, see Nachum chapter 1. The Hebrew Bible spilled far less blood than the New, with its God-man of love and its ethical pacifism, which has lately become very much in vogue thanks to Romain Rolland, Tolstoy, Stefan Zweig, Franz Werfel, and the non-Christian Gandhi. If the political world would have understood the Hebrew Bible, it would not have come to catastrophe. Great is vengeance, for it is positioned, for it was positioned between two letters, as it says, God of retribution, Almighty, God of retribution, appear. See Psalm 94. Kel Nekamos Hashem, Kel Nekamos Sophia, right? So you see the word, God's name appears in between. Kel Nekamos is Hashem. Kel Nekamos. So Hashem's name appears in between God of vengeance, God of vengeance. See Sanhedrin 92a. Vengeance appears between two names of the master of the universe. As they were dying in crematoria in Poland and Germany, our martyrs demanded vengeance. But what is vengeance? We cannot take physical revenge, and I doubt Jews would do so, against the hundreds of thousands of murderers, even if they could. Our hands are clean of blood, far cleaner than those of the Catholic nuns with their eyes trained heavenward. Could there be a greater form of vengeance, historical vengeance, undying vengeance, in a world that left us to be slaughtered and massacred and has sought to rid itself of us, than our very continued existence, paradoxically, mysteriously in contact with world culture, but simultaneously in opposition to the evil therein, dreaming an eternal vision of the end of days and vying with a mysterious universal man? And a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn. In spite of all of our enemies, and even many liberals and supposed friends who advise us to commit spiritual national suicide and undergo good-natured, painless self-dissolution, advisors who can probably be justified if we consider our suffering from the standpoint of Job, from the perspective of almighty fate, which plays with man as with a ball. We must, on the contrary, grow larger and more powerful, becoming spiritual giants like Abraham after the binding, or like Jacob after his tussle with the angel. We must capture the admiration and envy of the world, and with their blessing. And he blessed them there. Genesis 32. Moses received the rays of light not from the first giving of the Torah, but from the second. Why? The first giving of the Torah took place in the context of an apocalyptic theophany without suffering, paradoxes, enigmas, resistance, opposition, and tension. Quote, there was thunder and lightning and a dense cloud upon the mountain and a very loud blast of the horn. See Exodus 19. The mountain burned like fire. Angels soared through the air. 600,000 Jews went forth to accept the Torah, shouting, Naaseh v'nishma. We will do and we will listen. See Exodus 24. The whole cosmos was quiet, calm. The world was silent and still. Shmos Rabbah, section 29. The entire universe bore witness to the theophany, and Moses became the hero of mankind. The second giving of the Torah, by contrast, was full of suffering, disappointment, and mourning. The nation suddenly goes mad, creating a calf and repudiating the God that they had seen only a short while before. They go back to being slaves, idolaters, and wild men. God wishes to obliterate them, and the Shekhinah departs. Moses is on his own, fighting with the nation for God's sake. And also, as if one could say this, fighting with the master of the universe for the nation's sake. God says to him, quote, carve two tablets of stone like the first, Exodus 34. You want new tablets, Moses? Chisel them out yourself from stone. Take boulders and carve divine tablets out of the lifeless, unfeeling, cold rock. Quote, be ready by morning, and in the morning, come up to Mount Sinai and present yourself there to me on the top of the mountain. No one else will come up with you, and no one else will be seen anywhere on the mountains. Exodus 34. Moshe, you have no following. You stand alone, solitary. Betrayed by all. Go up to the mountain on your own, without thunder and lightning, without the blast of the horn, without God's voice, and without 600,000 Jews. All of them are sleeping, steeped in nonsense and egotistical trifles. You alone, lonely, forsaken, broken. And you will wait for me, not the other way around, as happened early in the morning on Shavuos. And how does God appear to Moses then? Not openly as before. When they saw the God of Israel under his feet, there was the likeness of a pavement of sapphire. See Exodus 24. No, heaven forbid. Rather, the Almighty came down in the cloud. God stood with him there. Exodus 34. Enveloped in clouds, mysteries, paradoxes, contradictions, suffering, and enigmas. Almost no divinity is visible. No providence perceptible. Everything is shrouded in shadow and darkness. It seems to Moshe that blind fate governs the world and Jewish history. Only lifeless boulders and sand stretch out before him into infinity. Mount Sinai is rocky, hard, indifferent to Moshe's dreams and hopes. The golden calf and its attendant dancing circles dictatorially rule the world. Moshe's fate is paradoxical. Everything ridicules him. His task is laughable. He will never fulfill it. No eternal Israel can emerge from the mixed multitude. Suffering, illogic, mysteriousness. But just in that moment, when Moshe finds himself, quote, in a cleft of the rock, Exodus 33, under a cold, unfeeling boulder, he sees God in a way he had never previously seen God in the heavens, and he hears the words of the 13 attributes of mercy. God, God, a God compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in kindness and faithfulness, extending kindness to the thousandth generation, forgiving iniquity, transgression, and sin, and he remits. Exodus 34. Moshe, out of paradox, a great vision must be born. From suffering and loneliness, bountiful kindness and faithfulness come into the world. Fate is transformed into destiny, self-determination, and free choice. And Moshe, crouching under the bold colder, becomes much greater, mightier, profounder, loftier, and more illustrious than when he was in the heavens. He becomes the master of all prophets and father of all sages, and his face begins to shine. And where, Moravim Rabbotai, can we carve tablets out of cold mountain boulders? And where can we implement the vision of God, God, a God compassionate and gracious, in contact with and in opposition to the rest of the world, if not in the land of Israel? Not in Reformed temples, not in conservative synagogues, not even in Orthodox Bate Knesset can any of this be implemented. Certainly all modern Jews are paradoxical, both vis-a-vis Gentiles and vis-a-vis themselves. The Gentile does not comprehend their existence as Jews, and they themselves do not understand it either. But these Jews' paradox is that of Job, a paradox of sharp, senseless, gratuitous pains that befall a man suddenly and break him. Their paradox is that of fate, of Greek tragedy, of Sophocles or Euripides, not that of Genesis or the self-determination of Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, and the other prophets. They lack the mystery of Jewish existence as a form of opposition to evil in the world. The paradox of the modern Jew is that of a man wrestled with him, but without the vision of until the break of dawn. Building the land of Israel is a task that is paradoxical in its entirety. However, it is not fatally paradoxical, but prophetically paradoxical, the paradox of free self-determination that is connected with suffering. Sometimes, in moments of gloom, during twilights of melancholy, when Satan, wrapped in shadow, asks me, will Jews succeed in their two gigantic undertakings, the building of the land in Palestine and the establishment of Torah everywhere, when there are so many Sanballats, destructive forces and adversaries, both internal and external, when ignorance, dismal assimilation, and indifferent resignation consume the organism of the Jewish nation like a cancer? I get disoriented for a moment. But then I suddenly remember the paradoxical, illogical, irrational nature of our task and the suffering with which the implementation of all of these ideals is bound up. In front of my eyes appears the scene of Abraham returning from the binding. Behind him, a paradoxical, ridiculous life that is simply full of contradictions, and learning that everything had come so easily to Nahor. The scene of Moses standing alone and seeing nothing but clouds and darkness and a tefillin knot. See Gemara Bracha 7a. In those moments, I answer Satan firmly, yes, we will succeed because the task is paradoxical and paradox is the eternal rule of our history. Is the building of the land paradoxical, enigmatic, and incomprehensible? Absolutely. Number one, our conflict with the Arabs, combined with the wickedness of many English imperial politicians, is ridiculous and crazy, like David facing Goliath. Number two, our struggle with the hard, desert-like terrain of the land of Israel in attempting to extract bread and wine from soil that lay desolate for thousands of years is paradoxical. Anyone who has been to the land of Israel and traveled through the Judean hills knows quite well what a difficult struggle our ancestors engaged in with its unfriendly nature so that it would become a land flowing with milk and honey. The same can be said of the fructification of the land of Israel today. I am no agronomist, but it seems to me that the task of greening the Negev is not only colossal, but paradoxical. Three, the paradox increases, growing larger and more incomprehensible. The resurrection of the Hebrew language, which is an absolute contradiction of linguistic history and psychology, is one of the greatest miracles in the world. To hear the language of the prophets in the mouths of infants and sucklings is a delight comparable to that of the world to come. Number four, the paradox becomes even more unnatural. The incomprehensible paradox of the land's holiness being in effect in its own time and for all time. The mysterious faith in the return to Zion and in the advent of the Messiah, which will one day be realized. The paradoxical affirmation, I believe with perfect faith in the coming of the Messiah, and even though he tarries, even so I shall await his coming every day, which Jews sang in the ghettos and which stretches back over a 2,000-year exile to the times of the prophets living in the land of Israel. This paradox, which is the source of the entire movement to return to Zion and which has influenced all of Jewish psychology, so that even today we sit on Tisha B'Av from Calcutta to New York to Jerusalem and we say, Zion, will you not inquire after the welfare of your imprisoned inhabitants? Those who seek your welfare, the remnants of your flocks, Kina 36 is one of the greatest wonders of history. Five, and this is the wildest paradox of universal significance, a Jewish land of Israel in general, and a Jewish state in particular, poses the greatest challenge to Christian, especially Catholic, dogma. Simply put, it contradicts fundamental principles of their exegesis of the Bible. Anyone who has even the most minimal familiarity with early Christian theology, from the times of Justin Martyr, Athenagoras, and Augustine, knows that the prophecies about the return to Zion were interpreted as applying to the church, and that Israel was understood as a reference to the Christian nations. And these exegeses are not simply biblical hermeneutics, but have dogmatic import. For if the redeeming Messiah has already arrived, then the return to Zion must have happened already as well. That is why the Catholic and the other Orthodox churches have been conspiring against the efforts on behalf of the return to Zion, and especially against the Jewish state. The return of Jewish sovereignty poses a direct challenge to the theoretical underpinnings of Orthodox Christianity. It is the greatest paradox in history, and it arouses the greatest opposition and tension. It is for that reason that, quote, the man who wrestled with him is so stubborn and embittered. If the Agudah's representatives, who, armed with both Talmudic analysis and political philosophy, came out against the Jewish state and almost pronounced a prohibition against it, would have had an inkling of the theological complications that would result for Catholicism from the attainment of Jewish sovereignty, they would repent and flog themselves. In the thousand-year polemic between Judaism and Christianity, the existence of a Jewish state would be the best argument, even from the perspective of Orthodox Christian theology. The report from the Anglo-American Committee of Inquiry does not say so openly, but its opposition to a Jewish state is due purely to Christian theology. Zion must not be allowed to become the state of the people of the Old Testament. The Christian apologists of the first centuries forbade it. I would suggest to many of our Talmudists that instead of confronting the committee with Talmudic analysis and trying to prove who is the greater scholar, they would do better by seeing to it that their own followers help to make this ideal a reality. That would be much more productive than showing Lord Justice John Singleton passages from Maimonides. He never asserted that he was a Talmudist or a yeshiva dean. Moray and Rabotai, I see here many of our Orthodox yeshiva youth who drink from the wellsprings of our halakha, who lead lives that, to the outside world, seem full of paradoxes and illogic, who truly live in opposition to their muted Jewish surroundings. Many Jews do not understand them. You know quite well how deeply and closely connected I am with Torah scholars. My students can attest to how much effort I put into formulating the Torah ideal for them. And I wish to note here that I do this not on account of tzidkus. I am far removed from being a tzaddik, but simply because the magic of the paradoxical opposition to a secular Jewish world fascinates me. The absurd and impossible enchant me and drive us all to undertake the ludicrous. Credo quia absurdum est, faith is ridiculous. Should we leave the great work of building the land of Israel with all of its historical complications and paradoxes and with the immensely significant influence it will exert on the lives of Jews in the diaspora in the hands of non-religious youth? At a harat olam hour, in the most critical period of our history, should we hide in caves and shadows and later groan about the desecration of Shabbos in the land of Israel? We have sinned gravely vis-a-vis the land of Israel, all of us, the Orthodox, the radical elements with their dreams of a universal redemption, even the Zionist Organization of America, with its salon politics and naive trust in the promise of a Lord. Had these mistakes been avoided, who knows how many Jews would now be planting vineyards in the Galilee and the Sharon instead of having gone up in smoke from the crematoria. The Jewish public must perform a great deal of tshuva. Everyone, without consideration of party or ideology. I know many who allowed no Mishaberach to be recited for the Jewish National Funds, but are now safe in Yerushalayim, of all places. They might be Gaonim and Tzadikim, but they made shameful blunders. A man of flesh and blood must err. Jacob sought to reveal the end time, but the Shechina departed from him. I have no claim specifically against them. All of us sinned. The key is to learn from historical mistakes. That is the foundation of tshuva, regretting the past and accepting to change in the future. But now Jews are coming to America and imitating them. They promulgate a ban against charitable funds for the land of Israel and against the shekel, voting ahead of the 22nd World Zionist Congress. At least those past Torah giants had a coherent system. But the half-baked American tzaddikim and Talmudists are also displeased with the movement to return to Zion. Such a position is completely ridiculous. Who will build the land of Israel? Be a Gura? You know what that cannot be. Therefore, we should not shy away from this historical task and miss our moment. At the same time, we suffer from another malady. There are many young Orthodox Jews, including rabbis, who identify as general Zionists or as members of the Histadrut. For them, it is either or. Either one has nothing to do with the land of Israel, or one allows the land of Israel to turn out the way the Reform Movement or HaShomer HaTzair wanted to. This is plain political ignorance and insincerity. The question now of the elections is not simply about delivering a sermon at the World Zionist Congress or seeking out honors. It is about the entire faithful politics of the coming two critical years and about the distribution of Zionist funds. Whether Hapoel HaMizrahi receives the support it deserves or is discriminated against depends to a large degree on the results of the shekels. And we Jews must not be so negligent as to either not buy any shekels whatsoever or not know where to buy them. However, Marav and Rabotai, friends, rabbis, and yeshiva youth, the question of the land of Israel reaches even deeper than we imagine. The whole future of the Torah depends on it. And I wish to stress again that I am definitely not one of the pessimists who foresee the collapse of American Jewry, and I am not asking for $1 million in order to forestall the plague. Quote, the glory of Israel does not deceive or change his mind. 1 Samuel chapter 15. I believe in that. True, it is paradoxical, but because it is incomprehensible, I believe that it is impossible to predict. Both optimists and pessimists should be a bit more conservative in their prophecies. There is, however, a danger to the diaspora if there is no Jewish center at the same time. I refer to the dimensions of Judaism. You know this well. A standard Euclidean space has three dimensions: length, width, and depth. Hermann von Helmholtz demonstrated that certain creatures in the zoological world cannot perceive a three-dimensional space, and their entire universe consists either of lines or of planes. It is difficult for us to imagine such a perspective on the world, and yet it is that of insects who cannot perceive a three-dimensional space. This same kind of differentiation in the perception of space can also be found in the spiritual sphere in general and in Judaism in particular. Judaism is not, in essence, an unidimensional line connecting man with God via certain ritual behavior. It is also not a two-dimensional plane with a Beit Midrash on one side and a cemetery on the other side. Judaism is an all-encompassing system of cosmic proportions in three-dimensional space, length, width, depth, deep, deep down. Who can discover it? Ecclesiastes chapter 7. It embraces the whole of life, one's entire existence. All modern problems must be refracted through the Jewish prism, and the Jewish consciousness must adopt a position on them. Sociological problems, political questions, cultural historical opinions, pedagogical methodologies, concepts like state and society, the relationship between the individual and the community, social ethics and justice, and population politics must be viewed in a Jewish light and understood from a Jewish perspective. The Torah's measure is longer than the earth and broader than the sea. See Job chapter 11. But if a Torah scroll is missing entire parshiot, it's invalid. Unfortunately, the way modern Judaism, even from Judaism, is developing in the diaspora, it is missing this three-dimensional perspective. It is limited to lines and planes. Judaism has become fossilized in the Beis Midrash, cemetery, and ceremonial forms. I'm not saying that these things are unimportant, but they are very far removed from reflecting the beauty and splendor within Judaism. This is Judaism without gusto, profundity, and loftiness. Flat, monotone, and gray. Is it any wonder that the younger generation does not want to hear from us? And it is difficult to entice its members to come to the synagogue? The young people going out into the street, full of socio-political problems and doubts, philosophical questions and queries, hearing nothing from our modern rabbis and non-Orthodox clergymen, but a couple hackneyed phrases and banal sayings. Why is that? Judaism, instead of being a worldview, has become a cult religion, that which Judaism despises to no end. The difficult method of deepening and broadening the Jewish Weltanschauung consists not only of theoretical analyses and philosophical work, that too is a difficult task, but even more so, of participating in such a life as compels Judaism to be reborn in its fullness and multidimensionality. The heaven is my throne, and the earth is my footstool, Isaiah 66. One can only have a heaven, an ideology, a spiritual conception of the world when there is terra firma beneath one's feet. When concrete, ordinary life demands it, requires depth, formulation, and framing of new values, new ideals, new norms and worldviews. When life is multidimensional, colorful, diversified, and deep, and as the Roman poet Terence said, I consider nothing human alien to me. Then will a multidimensional, all-embracing, heaven-storming Judaism emerge, riding through the heavens to help you, through the skies in his majesty, Deuteronomy 33. By contrast, when concrete life is robbed of many aspects of human creation, like a state, political activity, jurisprudence, the whole clash between capital and labor, a comprehensive education, and so on and so forth, then spiritual life perforce becomes crippled, shrinks, withers, and fades. Is it any wonder then that Judaism has become a cult religion, a ritual? There is no need to formulate a Jewish political philosophy, labor ideology, social ethics, and so on. For where those things are concerned, we live in a Gentile world. Here is where Achad Ha'am erred regarding the primacy of a spiritual center. A spiritual center is undoubtedly important. A spiritual renaissance is certainly needed. But there can be no spiritual center without a physical center. There can be no soul without a body. For us, the halacha follows the house of Hillel, which contends that the earth was created first and heaven thereafter. As it says, when the Almighty God made heaven, earth, and heaven. Genesis 2, quoted in Chagiga 12a, there can be no heaven without the earth. When the Almighty God made earth and heaven, first came earth, then heaven, there can be no heaven without the earth. In my opinion, it is here that the religious conception of the ideology of the return to Zion lies hidden. I do not refer simply to the mitzvah to settle the land or to other mitzvot connected with the land. Much more depends on this. The entire character of Judaism and its essence. Will Judaism remain a unidimensional line or a two-dimensional plane? Or will it be transformed into an all-encompassing space, long, wide, and deep, with distant horizons and unending boundaries? In a word, a true worldview? I believe that, even with the best of intentions, the Asper jury cannot accomplish this. Observance can exist, but not a multidimensional Jewish society. This is not simply some abstract reflection, but an actual necessity if we expect that out of Gehenna will emerge a new Jewish persona with a new view of life, a new system of values who will make the great paradox of Abraham's covenantal vision of Moshe's God, God, a God compassionate and gracious, a reality who will bring us both into contact with world culture and into tension with it. Contact and participation, but also tension and opposition. This is the prophetic ideal of a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn. And this can only be fulfilled in the land of Israel. There are no words. There is nothing to add. I have not read anything that powerful in a very long time. So I'm very sorry that I was breaking down every so often. I am completely shattered. Everybody have a good day. With God's help, we'll see you tomorrow night for Tanakh Tuesday.